no sunshine when she's gone. It's not warm when she's late. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. And she's always gone too long. Anytime she goes away.
Ah, yes, it's November, and our daylight is getting shorter. For many, that means we're getting bluer, too. It's called seasonal affective disorder, known as SAD, and it sets in for many of us this time of the year. We'll talk about what role weather plays in this condition today on Jet Streaming. Hello and welcome to Jet Streaming. We are one of the very few weather-related podcasts available on the web. Thanks for listening again this week. I'm Minnesota Public Radio Chief Meteorologist Paul Huttner, along with fellow NPR and longtime National Weather Service meteorologist Craig Edwards. Hi, Craig.
Good morning, Paul. Good to be with you again.
Good to talk to you as well. Our friend Kathy Werzer, not here this week. She is feeling a bit under the weather. Wonder if it's those November blues. We will look forward to Kathy's return next week. We start today with a look at our top weather stories of the week. Indonesia's Anak Krakatoa, or Child of Krakatoa, sprang to life in recent days with dazzling but small eruptions. As many as 100 explosions a day are sending smoke, ash, and flaming rocks 1,000 feet into the air. So far, geologists believe the eruptions will stay small and not be a major climatic event like Mount Pinatubo in 1991 or the huge eruptions in Krakatoa of 1883. The Mount Tambora eruption in 1815 cooled the planet and produced the year without a summer in New England in 1816. That summer featured snow, frost, and widespread crop failures.
Paul, one of the things I've noticed that sort of got lost in the headlines of the fires that were occurring out in the southwest portion of the United States was the continuation of the severe drought down in portions of Georgia, the Tennessee Valley, and into Alabama, where they're still 24 inches below normal at Huntsville for the year, 18.5 inches below normal at Atlanta. So that area of the United States has got politics entering into water conservation and water usage. So that's going to be an interesting story to continue to follow, particularly after the season where very few tropical storms replenish the soil with significant rainfall out in the southeast. So we'll keep following that story as the drought in the southeast is a concern as we head into a La Nina winter.
Yeah, nothing like a good tropical storm with soaking rains to end a drought down in the southeastern United States. Craig, I don't know if you saw this one. A new study by NOAA scientists shows that aerial sea ice coverage of the Arctic Ocean will decline by more than 40% by the summer of 2050 compared to the 1979 to 99 base period. NOAA meteorologist James Overland and Muyin Wang did the study, and it projects a continuation of the rapid trend of the polar ice decline we've already observed since the late 1970s.
Yeah, when NOAA starts getting into the circumstances of watching for ice melts, you know that we've got the government agencies now growing continually concerned about the acceleration of this ice melt. Now, here in Minnesota, we don't have the ice melt, but we could certainly use some moisture. Central Minnesota, who had the off precipitation from this summer and into the fall, where we set the record for August, September, and October being the wettest period on record here in the Twin Cities. All of a sudden, Paul, on October 19th, that precipitation shut off, so very little moisture. So if you planted a tree or a shrub this fall season after the 19th, you might want to water that before the frost sets in.
Yeah, I was out raking up those leaves. I noticed the garden getting a little dry once again on the topsoil. You know, it's estimated that millions of people this time of the year are affected by seasonal affective disorder, especially from now through the winter months of December, January, February. The condition is a depressive mood disorder that is directly linked to the reduction in sunlight during the winter. As many as 9% of us in Minnesota and the northern states may get SAD, but only about 1% in places like Florida and Arizona. It's that time of the year, isn't it, Craig?
Well, yeah, and I tell you what, when I have meteorologists in the office, we'd say after the middle of July, we go, well, you know, the daylight's getting shorter now. I says, please don't start. It's too soon for this. Paul, I really notice it's setting in after Thanksgiving. For some reason, there's a period in there that just really sucks the life out of me, and I have to admit that I do have the affective disorder, and I celebrate on February 15th that I think we're about out of that. So I use Valentine's Day as my trigger point to get over it and move on.
And I use mid-December because that's when the daylight starts getting longer, at least in the evening for sunset time. We've got somebody to help us here today, Craig. Joining us is Dr. David Adson. Dr. Adson is a professor at the University of Minnesota's Department of Psychiatry, and he specializes in the diagnosis of seasonally affected disorder and using light therapy to treat it. Dr. Adson, welcome to Jet Streaming.
Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity to join you this morning.
So what is SAD?
Basically, SAD is a variant of major depressive disorder or bipolar depressive disorder that has a seasonal pattern. And in order to have a seasonal pattern, you have to have it as an exacerbation of an underlying depression. But more commonly, we see just seasonal changes associated with the diminishing light in the fall and through the winter. And I would say the majority of us Minnesotans have some kind of seasonal changes
the winter. Do we know the exact cause? Is it the reduced daylight? Does temperature play a role?
Well, you know, it appears to be it's all about light. And you can come up with all sorts of theories about serotonin levels and melatonin, but as with the majority of psychiatry, we're not real sure what's going on.
Doctor, is there a gender bias or an age bias to this that longtime residents in the northern latitudes can overcome this? And is this something that's fairly new as far as diagnosis, or is this something that possibly occurred even in the 1800s?
Well, first off, in regards to the gender issue, as with all mood disorders, women are about twice as commonly affected. In terms of the amount of time that it's been described, it actually goes back to the ancient Greek times, where Greek scholars mentioned some seasonal changes, but it was formally introduced by Norman Rosenthal to the psychiatry literature in 1984.
Let's talk about some of the geographic locations that are more strongly influenced by SAD. Is it just a northern issue?
It seems to be a northern hemisphere. Of interest, I was at a psychiatric conference in Chicago a few years ago, and I was talking to a psychiatrist from southern Illinois. He said he never saw it.
Huh.
In contrast, I was talking to a psychiatrist from Hibbing, from the Iron Range. He said about half of the people he treats for depression take the antidepressants only during the wintertime.
Well, I got to tell you, living in Indianapolis for 15 years, I was okay because the temperatures were reasonably mild in the wintertime down there, and the snow didn't last long. But I think it was accumulation effect when I moved to Minnesota, is the shorter daylight hours, the colder weather, and a prolonged period of having to deal with ice and snow and slick roads, and it sort of wore you down. When you talk about depression, it was sort of like, well, there's an accumulation of factors, not just the daylight, but the chill and the cold and the whole fact that there was just not a lot going on. And I remember one of the first advice that was given me when I moved up here from Indianapolis was by a teacher at Minnetonka High School. He says, get into an activity in the wintertime. Be able to force yourself to get outdoors. He says, once you get confined to your home at 5 o'clock at night, he says, you've got to be able to get yourself out of the house again.
Well, that speaks to a lot of the problem is that we tend to isolate, and that's part of just the mood changes, and then that leads to us not getting outside, and then again, you're not exposed to as much light.
So how do we treat SAD? Is it exercise? Is it full spectrum lights? Is it vodka, or is that a bad thing?
Well, generally speaking, distilled spirits are not a good idea if you have a tendency towards depression. But yeah, I think it's activity and especially outside activities. I was actually just looking at something on the web, trying to figure out exactly what's involved with these light levels we talk about, and the standard measure of light intensity is a lux, LUX. And it turns out on a sunny summer day, you're exposed to about 80,000 lux,
mm-hmm.
whereas a cloudy winter day, we're talking about 3,000 lux.
Yeah.
And the average home interior is only like 100. And just to give you some perspective, 1 foot from a single candle is 11 lux.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're hanging out in the winter with candlelight, you're in trouble in terms of light exposure.
So even an hour outside on a winter day can be a real good thing.
Right. Then you're at least exposed to perhaps 3,000 lux, or if it's sunny, way higher. But in terms of the light therapy, then you're talking about sitting in front of a light box, using it for in the morning. You want the light exposure in the morning. Otherwise, you can mess up your sleep schedule.
Well, speaking of that, out at the National Weather Service, we're rotating shift workers. One of the things I did for the staff a couple of years ago was I did get these lights that we put in the office for the operations area to help simulate a more natural lighting. And I was wondering if there's a greater impact then on SAD for shift workers that have already screwed up biological clock, so to speak, that they're trying to sleep during the daylight hours, and so by the time they get up, it's dark again. So that was one of the things that wore me down, that if I worked a midnight shift, came home, went to bed, I went to bed in the dark and got up in the dark.
Right. But I'm just interested, did you see an effect with the lighting in the workplace?
Well, I think I did. It seemed like when I would come into the office in the morning at 7 a.m., it seemed like there was more energy.
Right.
But it's hard to measure that with just an observation. But let me tell you this. They were happy to have that, and nobody said take those lights out of there. Matter of fact, I ended up putting more of those lights in throughout the office.
And, Craig, you were the boss, too, so of course they were real energetic when you walked in the morning, right?
You know, Paul, that's probably the deal. They probably saw me coming and says, everybody pick it up a notch, make it look like we are alert. But I think the fact that putting those lights in signaled to them that it was a concern that I had, that we want the employees better health or to be sharp, to be the performers they can be, and not let anything detract from that, particularly a seasonal defective disorder.
Well, that speaks to some of the specific attributes of seasonal affective disorder. Aside from just having a depressed mood, loss of interest, sleep disturbances, etc., you get with depression, you also have kind of the special features of oversleeping, fatigue, social withdrawal, and then the carbohydrate cravings. So you can see some people really putting on some weight during the winter as well.
So the best advice then, doctor, for those of us who get a little bit of the winter blues, what are the biggest three or four things that you would remind folks during the next few months?
Basically, try to get outside as much as possible, obtain a light or any kind of increased light in your workplace, and really do, as you're coming into the holidays, really have to watch out for the holiday cheer. You get into these parties, overconsumption of alcohol and food, and it's just too much going on. So you want to reduce your stress levels. And by all means, schedule a vacation in Mexico in January.
It's already done. I'm booked.
Very good.
Dr. Addison, thank you so much for helping us out today.
You bet. I really enjoyed it. Thank you. Would you like to ride?
Last week on Jet Streaming, we talked with meteorologist Bob Maddox, who's a longtime severe storm researcher and was director of NOAA's National Severe Storms Laboratory from 1986 to 96. Maddox reported some problems with data being collected by new radio sonde weather balloons deployed by the National Weather Service around the country. Dan Luna, who runs the Twin Cities office of the National Weather Service, reacted to some of the concerns raised by Maddox during last week's podcast.
Well, to my knowledge, and I've only been in charge of the weather office here for about a year, so I inherited what we were doing, but we were one of the beta sites, or one of the first sites to test the replacement system for the old upper air system, and we were one of five across the country.
Some meteorologists, for example, Dr. Bob Maddox, the former director of the National Severe Storms Lab, have highlighted and seen some problems with these data. He's put some specific examples on his website. I'm curious, do National Weather Service national leaders and program managers agree with folks like Bob that this is that there are some data problems, and are there any fixes in the works?
Well, I don't know if the Weather Service leadership agrees with Bob or not. I do know that Weather Service leadership is aware that there is some missing data at times, and we may have a dry bias in the humidity levels. And yes, there are fixes in place. As with anything else in the field of meteorology, sensors can malfunction and do malfunction, but the beauty is the meteorologists have the ability to correct the data, which is what we do if we suspect that upper air data is not accurate, or we just don't use the upper air data in the weather models.
And how will you correct, say, an upper air data? For example, I've heard that perhaps some of the wind data may have been missing at times from some of the soundings, including here in Minneapolis. How can you correct that if you don't actually have the data from a certain layer in the atmosphere?
Well, if the data is missing, we can't correct it. But in terms of the humidity data, it was there, so that was corrected. And the missing wind data, that problem's been solved already. That just required a change in frequencies, which we did a little while ago.
And was that have to do with FM radio signals perhaps interfering with the GPS chips in the radio sounds?
That's my understanding, is that it involved FM radios.
How much of a problem has this been, Dan? Is it spotty? How reliable is the data, and what kind of gaps have you seen?
Well, the data's far superior by an order of magnitude compared to what we used to get with the old upper air balloons 5 years ago or so. And I checked with what we consider to be the science experts east of the Rocky Mountains, and their opinions are that this is really not an issue in this part of the world. It may be a bigger issue out west where the climate is more arid, but the science officers I checked with just didn't feel this was much of an issue right now for us, and we don't feel that any forecasts have been impacted in a negative way or any warnings have been impacted in a negative way. And by and large, because if the data is missing or if the data is wrong and we correct it, that's not the only source of data we have. We have so much data these days that we have a lot more good data that overwhelms missing or corrupted data.
Can you think of any days specifically where, for example, the humidity data that we use, critical for forecasting severe storms on summer days? I know Bob Maddox has an example from Tucson on his website. Do we have any days this past summer when there was missing wind or other data here that may have been an issue with respect to forecasting severe storms?
No, we did not have any here this past year or the previous year. And I checked with our science expert here, and he said even if the sounding was drier, it would only be drier by 1 degree, he thought. And that just didn't have an impact here.
Okay, and finally, what do you think the people of Minnesota should think about the reliability of these radio sounds and how they impact the forecasts? Are they 100%, or are we still working a few bugs out like we often do with new technology?
We have no technology that's 100% yet, so I don't think we can expect 100%, but we can certainly expect 99% or better.
Craig, interesting topic, kind of caught my eye when it came out. Apparently, some of the problems, according to Bob, and he's documented them pretty well on his website, fairly widespread with the radio sound units themselves, the technology involved around parts of the country. You had a little perspective, a little experience with this. What do you think of this issue as we go forward?
Well, I got to be candid with you, Paul. I was at the office running the Twin Cities office when this new deployment was coming out. We were using technology that was developed in the 1950s. Really not much to it. You have a balloon with a parachute attached to it, and the equipment itself, the radio sound, had been replaced a couple times, giving us real reliable data. The National Weather Service had to do an overhaul of the whole system, so there was a national program with the national bids, contracts, and I don't want to use this term, but quite honestly, in government we say it goes to the low bid. Mm-hmm. And there was not a lot of people interested in this project, since it was a pretty specialized project with the National Weather Service. So we were looking to replace this technology that needed to be replaced. The unfortunate thing I saw when the deployment was starting to occur, and we were about the third office in the country to get that, and there's about maybe 100 of them in the United States. We were putting this equipment in, Paul, and what they had to do to put the new equipment in is they had to take the old equipment out. So one of the things that concerned me was that there wasn't a parallel comparison from the old equipment to the new equipment, so you could get a good baseline of what one technology might be doing over the other. So what they had to do, they had to come in and replace the entire equipment with the new stuff and take the old equipment out. And I tell you what, there was a lot of investigation, not investigation, but a lot of oversight to this project.
Sure. And
we would have weekly meetings of what we were seeing was happening. So I had a person in charge of this who had 40 years experience with the upper air program, and he would send every little I and T that didn't get dotted or crossed back to the program manager. So this was now 2 years ago, Paul, that we put this equipment in.
Right, and anybody who's ever put a new computer in knows there's issues when you change over technology. Real quickly, Craig, did you see the specific problems with missing wind data and missing data? And where do you think we are today? Bob is still saying that we've still got issues out there. There are fixes, I'm hearing, coming from the Weather Service. What's your sense of that?
Paul, I was aware of the wind data, and we were trying to correct that, and there was a way of sorting it out, and it was becoming a national issue. I didn't see a problem being reported with the humidity sensors that was detecting, as Bob Maddox might have pointed out, too dry, that it was exaggerating the dryness of the atmosphere. But there was some problems with the winds, and we were documenting those problems.
All right, and as I said, some fixes hopefully on the way with that here in the coming weeks. Well, it's that time again for the Weather Website of the Week. An interesting new website sprang up this week. It's called Cumulus, or CUMUL.US. Yeah, I guess you could call it a community weather forecast website. Cumulus allows users to make their own weather forecasts, enter them into the site, and then it combines and averages all of those forecasts to make the forecast for any given city. It also lets you select the type of clothing you are expected to wear today. Not sure about the accuracy of all that combined wisdom, but definitely worth a look at www.cumul.us. And, of course, we will link that on the Jet Streaming podcast website for you. All right, Craig, that should do it for this week. Thank you so much.
Always good to talk to you, Paul. I appreciate the opportunity to share some insight on this upper air situation that we have going on.
And a great insight it is. Thanks to all you weather geeks out there who help us keep going with the podcast. And thanks to our engineer, Scooter, and to our producer, Sarah Fleener. Until then, next week, remember to keep your weather eyes on the sky.
Keep on the sunny side.